Back When is sponsored by Siwi, the National Trust's photo printing partner. Every image captures a story. Siwi's support means the National Trust can protect our nation's memories by caring for and sharing our vast collection of historic photographs. Through our work together, we're uncovering precious and previously unseen images for everyone to enjoy. Discover our work snapshotting 200 years of history. Search online for Siwi, that's C-E-W-E, and the National Trust.
It's Sunday, the 14th of January, my dad's birthday, happy birthday. We set off this morning, early morning, from the campsite at Cradle Mountain. We're surrounded by tree ferns, which are mammoths, and all different types of ferns. It's a really, really cool and damp, and it's just amazing kind of environment to walk around in, so different to the environments that we've been to already.
Have you ever imagined being a fly on the wall of history? Join me for an inside view of the stories of people, places, and moments that made us. I'm historian James Grasby. Lean in for a tale from time. Back When. This story is one that has been growing with us for a long time, with the seeds being sown almost 100 years ago. It takes place in a faraway land with blood-sucking beasts, rope bridges, waterfalls, and poisonous plant life. Welcome to the tale of the plant hunters. The voice you heard at the start is that of Charlie Bancroft, a gardener from Nymans in West Sussex, who in 2018, alongside a team of botanists from across the UK and Ireland, were presented with a discovery. The diary and collecting notes of a Mr. Harold Coomber.
Harold Coomber went on two trips, one to Chile in, I think, 1925, and then he went to Tasmania and stayed there for a year.
The Coomber family have played an important role in the history of Nymans and its ornate gardens and grounds.
So you had James Coomber, the head gardener here at Nymans, and Harold Coomber was his son. And Harold Coomber grew up on the estate as a young boy and then got interested in horticulture and went on to do these two plant hunting expeditions.
Towards the start of 2018, a call was made by Mary Miles Coomber, the daughter of Harold, to the then head gardener of Nymans. In her possession were the blueprints, a treasure map, if you will, detailing all of the plants and collections gathered from Harold's 1929 expedition to Tasmania.
Harold Coomber is someone that's not relatively well known in the horticultural world in terms of bringing plants to the UK. And so the head gardener set out that he wanted to kind of celebrate Harold Coomber. And one of the ways to do that was to follow in one of the expeditions. I think on receiving the information and these collecting notes, got really, really excited about it. And that was kind of, the impetus to want to go. Tasmania was picked because there used to be a Tasmanian walkway in the Wild Garden, which has been lost now. So it was to restore the Tasmanian walkway, highlight Harold Coomber as a plant hunter. And also my role here at Nymans was to restore the rock garden and a lot of the flora that they have in Tasmania. They have a lot of like alpine and subalpine flora. And so that would have been perfect for growing in the rock garden.
A plan was hatched, and together with a team from Mount Stuart in Northern Ireland, the National Botanical Gardens of Wales and the Republic of Ireland, Charlie and head gardener at the time, Stephen Herrington, boarded a plane to the Southern Hemisphere on Project Bibbert, the British and Irish botanical expedition to Tasmania. While the team headed off on a conservation mission for public benefit, historically these plant hunters or plant collectors would have been funded by private financiers keen to flex on their foliage.
Plant collecting really came to life in the 19th century when lots of new plants were discovered in various foreign countries. My name is Caroline Eichen and I'm the curator at Nyman's in Standen. People were going off to places like China and Japan where foreigners hadn't been in before, the borders were closed until the second half of the 19th century. And there was this great demand in Britain and elsewhere in Europe for new and exciting plants. Plant collectors were sent out sometimes by nurseries, sometimes by private collectors or botanic gardens. And they brought back plants to Britain, plants and seeds, which really changed the face of gardens. They were able to plant colourful bedding plant schemes with some of these exotic plants coming back. They were able to fill their glasshouses with orchids and other unusual plants and tropical specimens. They were able to plant arboretums, so these fantastic new types of fir trees and monkey puzzle trees were coming back. So there was all sorts of new opportunities for gardening.
For Charlie, our modern-day collector, a love for collecting specimens began at a young age, although these were rarely plants.
No, my dad had an allotment and I hated going. Like, really hated it. But always, like, being interested in the outdoors and nature. When we used to go on walks, I just used to collect anything and bring it home, like sheep skulls and bones of things or anything that I'd collect, and then my mum would have to be trying to clean it because we brought it home. I always think the plant that got me interested in horticulture was a fritillaria or snake's head, and they're purple and white checkerboard. I don't know if you've seen them, like a bell-like flower. Real, like, how did nature decide to create this thing with these squares of white and purple? Like, it just seems totally crazy. Yeah, Dad finds it hilarious that I do it for a job now, and I hated it, and yeah, have kind of got into it from a second career, but I, like, totally fell into it, but I feel like I was probably meant to fall into it somehow, yeah.
Arriving in Mi Enna, the Bibbit team were joined by members from the Royal Tasmanian Botanical Gardens for the lowdown on local flora and to get the essentials for the adventure.
So we met up with them. I think they just wanted to check that we had everything that we kind of needed, like herbarium presses for collecting the herbariums. And you need lots of bags or envelopes for seed collecting. And then you need to be able to process that seed in the evening. And also, because it was the Botanic Garden, they had like their native plant section. So I just like kind of just went straight there and just thought, this is where we need to be kind of just looking. Because although we'd done research before we went, everything was just online or in books. I hadn't actually seen anything. And so, yeah, it was just trying to just soak up that before you're on the road. The good thing about a botanic garden is that everything's labelled. So you look at the plant and then you immediately look at the label to see what it is. But obviously, when you're in the field, nothing's labelled. You're just having to identify it as much as you can at that time. A lot of plants are endemic to Tasmania, so I wouldn't have seen them anywhere else necessarily. So the whole process of being out was a total kind of new experience for me, that I was just seeing plants that, just to look round to think, I don't recognise anything here.
After a few days training in the bag, the Bibbit team ventured out. Their first stop, Lake Augusta, a shimmering body of water flanked by alpine parabolic sand dunes, an extremely rare habitat that has been formed by the winds over many centuries. With local guide James Wood from Tasmania's Seed Bank at her side in 2018, Charlie discovered what makes this place unique and an essential stop for Harold Kumba.
What's really fascinating about this area that we're in now is that we're sitting on the edge of an alpine sand dune system. So sand dunes are things that people tend to think of being as coastal, but you can get alpine sand dune systems. They're not very common, but Lake Augusta is one of those spots you go to, and that really houses a really interesting and quite diverse, quite unique community vegetation here. And there's a number of plants that really only occur in this area. There's a number of rare and threatened species that occur in this area as well. There's also some fairly unique insects that live in this area.
Tasmania doesn't have kind of high mountains, but we were collecting higher up rather than at the lowland because it doesn't get as cold there as it does in the UK. So obviously we wanted to collect the hardiest plants that we could. So if you collect higher up, they're obviously going to be experiencing colder temperatures. So hopefully hardier for UK gardens. We were always kind of climbing up somewhere. And so you would get to these plateaus and it was almost like a painting. There would always be like a lake and then you would have these shrubs almost as if they'd been planted specifically there. Probably say this about every spot, but it was just beautiful.
Having spent the day hiking around Lake Augusta and its sand dune system, the next challenge for the team was vertically towards the summit of Projection Bluff, a notable peak within the mountain ranges of Tasmania. It's there that head gardener of Nyman's during the expedition, Stephen Herrington, was hot on the trail of a rare blue and pink poppy collected by Harold Kumber.
So we've been climbing for an hour or so now, and we're virtually at the top of the summit, probably about 1,300 metres. I've just spotted this amazing Olearia, Flagga pupa. And so Kumber collected this when he was out here in 1930, and he actually collected a pink and blue form, but it's not really out here much anymore. We haven't seen it. So we're hoping to catch it again as we go up. But I'm just going to... So this is, it's kind of a daisy bush on the side of the mountain here, but you can just see for absolutely miles right across the country.
Stephen was amazing to go with because he'd get really excited, like all of us, about everything that we saw. Wasn't too strenuous, but I think obviously you're getting really excited about the plants, so you're darting about rather than just going straight up. Your trajectory is a little bit wiggled.
A few days in, it was starting to dawn on the team how lucky they were to be living in modern times with relatively easy access compared with the earlier expeditions.
When you read his diary, Tasmania wasn't as easy accessible as when he was there. A lot of the time he was on horseback or just trekking, whereas we could get roads to certain places and we had cars. And like the bush is just like a thick... It's impenetrable to try and get through. So for him, like, and he talks about that so much that it was just really difficult to actually access certain places. So in a way, we had it a bit easier, I think. And also with like modern technology and things. And but yeah, for him, I just think quite a feat to undertake.
The reliance on botanists from abroad is nothing new and is something Harold Kumber will have had to hand. But it's only really in the modern day that the local experts have been celebrated. Britain and its gardeners had the weight of an empire behind them, so the recognition of local knowledge was often an afterthought, as Caroline Aikin explains.
Well, when the plant collectors were going abroad, they would plan their trips to certain areas to target particular plants, usually, and they would, in advance, make contact with botanic gardens and perhaps local colonial administrators who would help them with the logistics of their planning, because they were often going into quite literally uncharted territory. So they were very reliant on local people and local knowledge to guide them to where the plants were growing, to guide them over, you know, streams and mountains and treacherous terrain. The local people of the area are really the unrecognised heroes of these plant collecting expeditions. They were the ones with the knowledge and the expertise, and without them, you know, facilitating the plant collecting trips, then really, you know, they would have been much less successful. I think nowadays we tend to think of the plant collectors as heroic types, generally men who braved all sorts of personal hardships and physical hardships in the pursuit of collecting these plants. And I think there certainly was a bit of that. They were clearly very determined individuals. But we have tended to forget the reliance on the local people to help them. Often these people are unrecorded. We don't know their names. We don't know much about them. But we certainly know they were there helping. And without their help, none of this would have been possible.
Recordings of the local people were not the only thing that were often overlooked by the collectors.
also a lot of these collectors were going into parts of the world where they didn't really have permission to be. Often they were deliberately sneaking over borders to collect in places like Tibet, where there's sort of political differences and they shouldn't really have been there. So they were breaking the rules a bit in pursuit of these plants. And when the plants came back to Britain, there was this sense that they'd suddenly been discovered. But of course, these plants had been known forever in their countries of origin. They'd been used by local people. They might have had medicinal uses or culinary uses. And all that knowledge was really unrecorded and forgotten when the plants came back to Britain. And they were seen as these great new discoveries, new plants in Britain. So there was a certain amount of kind of whitewashing of the origins of these plants and the peoples who had used them in their native lands. And there's also the environmental destruction. I mean, they weren't just taking one or two seeds from plants. They were literally collecting thousands of seeds. There's records of taking tens of thousands of bulbs. So literally, you know, wiping out single species from different parts of the hillside or the countryside where these things were growing. So there are some sort of problematic environmental and cultural things that we need to think about when we're celebrating these plant collectors today, because yes, they brought an awful lot of benefit to British horticulture, but some of it was at the expense of some of the other countries in the empire and beyond where these plant collectors were operating.
As well as the challenges presented by the landscape, the team also had to go toe-to-toe, quite literally, with the local wildlife. Coming face-to-face with an egg-laying mammal and a bloodthirsty creature lurking in the long grasses, as the team recalled back at their base.
And we actually saw an echidna on the way back, which is, yes. I think, a bonus. Mm. Don't often get a chance to see an egg-laying mammal, but one just wandering alongside the road, which is a nice bonus at the end of the day, heading back home.
Yeah, but what wasn't such a bonus was it with the leeches.
I don't think
anyone survived.
No, everybody got the leeches. Yeah, so
it's not a real Tasmanian bush experience if you haven't picked up several leeches and filled one of your socks full of blood. So that's all part of the experience.
The button grass is a beautiful grass that they've got out there, and the flower does look like a button. It's very dense grass and it grows in wet, almost like a peaty moorland. And so it thrives with leeches. And obviously the first time we didn't know that, and we went in there collecting, and then someone was like, oh, I've got something on me. And then before you knew it, everyone had the leeches everywhere, which the leeches were small and they weren't a problem. I think what was a problem was you didn't know where they'd got, and later that day you were still finding leeches. But in terms of a lot of the things that we could have encountered in Tasmania, leeches were nothing. And I think we did get quite gung-ho, because you are just putting your hand in a shrub to collect the seed, and you kind of just, it that becomes the norm. And we did see a few snakes as we were walking, but only a few times that you did kind of get a bit blasé about it and think, oh yeah, this is fine.
One of the plants that first caught Charlie's eye was like something from another planet.
Well, they have like these, they're called Richia pandanifolias, and they're just like massive columns, really. And then it just has this crazy bit of foliage at the top. And I remember Harold Coombs just saying how alien they are and how they don't look like anything else that should be in that habitat, because most of the flora is like, you've got the eucalyptus and you've got Nophophagus, like, which is a very small tree in comparison to eucalyptus. And then you've got a lot of scrub, so a lot of shrubs and things. And then you've got this Richia pandanifolia, which is just totally just this column that just sticks out. So yeah, that was crazy to see.
Plant collecting has really changed the face of gardens in Britain. I mean, there's no doubt about it that these new plants coming in from abroad gave all sorts of new possibilities in terms of garden design, in terms of building up collections of trees and in arboretums, in terms of decorating great show glasshouses full of orchids and tropical plants, creating big bedding schemes and parterres. All these things were made possible because of the new plants that were suddenly flooding the market. But of course, now there are much tighter controls on plants that can be brought in terms of giving recognition and some benefit to the countries that they're coming from and those peoples that live in some of those places. You know, plants are now quarantined when they come into Britain, whereas in the past, they just came in their Wardian cases, which is the plant cases that they brought them over with soil from other countries, with plant material, with bugs and worms and everything in the soil was all coming back to Britain. And you can imagine the sort of damage that that was causing, introducing pests and pathogens that weren't known to Britain before. Now, when plant collectors do go out, there's all sorts of regulations and things put in place so that we minimise environmental damage to Britain and to the countries that we're taking material from.
Today, collectors will still be furnishing private collections and nurseries. But there is also a new wave of plant lovers whose goal is to protect the rarest of the rare and to prolong the continuation of plant species in the growing battle against climate change. Gardens across the world are changing, and it's only with expert knowledge that we can work together to ensure that they can still be enjoyed for years to come. Thank you for listening to this episode of Back When. Be the first to hear new stories by following us on your favourite podcast app. And don't forget to join in with the episode by leaving a comment or sending us a message. All of the details can be found in our episode show notes. And while you're there, and if you've enjoyed this episode, then you can hear it again on our sister show, Wild Tales with Rosie Holdsworth. Join us again next time for more Tales from Time Back When.
This podcast is sponsored by Siwi, Europe's leading photo printing company. Every image you capture tells a story. Discover ideas for curating and creating your special memories and unique gifts for loved ones. From high-quality, personalised photo books to wall art made from your favourite photos. Head to Siwi, that's cewe.co.uk, and start creating your story.